Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Ned Bolting.
I'm Laura Laker.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And this time we're discussing the budget and how while cycling and walking often see relatively little in the way of funding at these times, they actually offer very good returns on the investment of taxpayers' cash, hard-earned taxpayers' cash. While cycling and walking improvements generate low-carbon journeys that benefit health, air quality and congestion, roads tend to do the opposite. Despite decades of largesse, more, bigger and faster roads and cars have increased motor traffic and danger. Before we come to that, though, Laura, what have you been up to?
Had COVID, got over it. That was happy. Been cycling a bit. What else have I been doing?
Writing your book.
Oh, yeah, doing my book. Yes, I'm doing that every day now.
How many words?
Well, chapter two currently has 13,000 words, which is a few too many words.
It's quite long, yeah.
Yeah, it's way too long. So I've kind of incorporated various things, which
who's chapter two all about?
So it's a couple of rides that I went on, and then I've started inserting the history of NCN into it. So, the kind of chapter one sets the scene, and then chapter two, I sort of do a ride, and then I get into history, and then, yeah. But yeah, it's quite a lot. I mean, it's obviously very different from writing an article. There's a lot of information. It's about when you bring it in. And so, yeah, I think it's going well. Just need to cut a lot out.
Okay. Am I going to get cut? I might be in the book. Do you think I'm going to get cut?
No, you're going to be in there. Yeah.
Not 13,000 words, though. I don't know. 250 words about you, Ned, if you're lucky.
What about you, Ned? You've been everywhere.
The stand-up show. It was so good.
It was really, really good.
It was really, really good. I really, really enjoyed it, Ned. Went to Leamington Spa.
Richmond, the home of cycling.
Well, I said that wherever I went.
Yeah.
I just lied to audiences all around the country, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm quite glad it's over because it involved me, well, as you now know, and that now it's fine to be a spoiler, it involved me walking on the stage without any trousers on, which was an idea I had before I had any other ideas. When I was starting to get into a panic about what can I put in this show, and I thought, well, it's quite important that you make people laugh at the beginning. How do you make people laugh? No trousers. That's normally how you make people laugh. So for a long time, that was the only idea I had. And then I was kind of like wedded to it, and then I couldn't get out of it. So it's like, yeah. Anyway, it's all over now. But thank you both for coming. That was much appreciated. What have you been up to? Saving the world, or at least them?
Well, I went to Laser Quest, not really saving the world, and, you know, but with my son, that was, yeah, it was great fun. It hasn't changed at all since I did it when I was a kid. Quite incredible, really. What I've been doing is what we're going to talk about now, really, the kind of budget conversation that there is. It's a really important time with Active Travel, and in my commissioner role, I've been looking at accelerating the stuff that we're doing. The government's been talking about, you know, more delivery, faster, those kind of things. But there's also probably quite a valid concern that there's going to be a drain on public finances, and, you know, you have to be pragmatic and get the right arguments across with this, and it's not going to just be on passion alone. And we have to remember that Active Travel delivers great returns, and, you know, there's a whole debate at the moment around which services need to be kept ring-fenced, protected, if you like. You know, I've even heard some commentators, ministers, ex-ministers saying that, oh no, active travel is a luxury, it's a nice to have, and we have to kind of battle that. So, you know, I think it's worth looking at this whole topic of how we talk about active travel, how we calculate whether it's a good thing to do, how people perceive it, because this stuff really matters, and without funding, you don't have active travel.
So convince me, I am a new transport minister. You've got 5 minutes of my precious time. Yes. And I'm thinking I'm under enormous pressure from my constituents and from various lobbying groups to invest everything that I've got in the rail and the road, and particularly the road building at the moment, because that's the beating heart of our economy, isn't it? So that's what I'm going to focus on. But why should I not, you know, why should I? What should
well,
I
the first thing I'd say is, why aren't you wearing any trousers? I know. I think, honestly, this conversation I have had over letters over the last couple of weeks, and, you know, we've had a couple of governments as well. So we've had to change the tack a little bit. And you'll have heard with Liz Truss, there was a lot of conversation around road building. We heard that a lot in her speeches. You know, we're going to build roads. We're going to... Yeah, and that's kind of quite a traditional view of infrastructure building and the economic return, but it is all slated against this potential economic return. And we see that time and time again, actually, that it's an uncomfortable truth. It never quite works out how it should. So there's a study a couple of years ago, actually, on the M25, you know, the business case for road building, road widening, like on the M25, basically comes down to relieving congestion, improving journey times. So what they did is they built an extra lane onto the M25, and because they built an extra lane, it became more popular, and the journey times improvements lasted for about a year and then went back to what they were again, obviously several millions of pounds later. So we know that this happens, but it is quite an abstract conversation to kind of understand and get your head around. So, you know, I think a lot of people do just take it as a given that if you build big roads, then you get the kind of benefits. And obviously you've got economic activity coming from the connections and from the building itself. But I think we need to, you know, not play at the same game, but active travel is going to really deliver proper green growth. So what I'd be saying to the Secretary of State and to ministers is, active travel can be implemented really, really quickly in a 1 to 2 to 3 year time frame, way quicker than road building, with much higher benefit cost ratios, and you get all the health benefits with the NHS as well. There's a lot of conversation in the media at the moment around people who are off on long-term sick, and obviously some of those people, you know, rightly won't be able to work or be as economically productive. But we also know that active travel can be a huge preventative measure in the nation's health, in public health, and that's been shown in countries that have really prioritized active travel. So we need to talk a slightly different language, I think, when it comes to active travel. And it's so often been about net zero or health on its own, but really there's quite a strong economic case which hasn't really been made very well before and is starting to be made now.
Can I ask a devil's advocate question about that whole widening the M25 thing and then it fills up, which is a kind of an argument that you quite often hear from people like you, do-gooding people like you on that side. No, but I often hear it and I kind of nod along as if, yes, that's my experience of kind of witnessing that. But I suppose the other side to that might be, if they hadn't widened the M25, a similar number of people would have acquired vehicles and carried on buying cars, and the congestion would have been worse.
Well, I think it's interesting because what happens is you actually build better infrastructure, regardless whether that's a road or, you know, the Elizabeth Line or something like that. And guess what? People go and use it. So that's a good thing. But what you actually have found with the M25 is that people that weren't using it before are now using it because instead of local roads to do the, you know, jump at one junction to do the school run, etc., to bypass a congested single track, single road, dual carriageways, things like that. And that means that more people are going to be using the infrastructure. I mean, it's not the kind of infrastructure that we know that we need lots of people using for things like decarbonisation, etc. And we know in places like, well, South Korea, for example, that when they actually took lanes away or got rid of quite big infrastructure, the traffic actually decreases. So you have what's called traffic evaporation. And that's really abstract. You know, people don't quite understand that if you actually give less road space, less people will use it and more people will be inclined to use the alternatives, which are more convenient. And, you know, that's hard to get your head around. It's hard to say to people, we don't want you to use this. You know, that goes against the grain of growth of all, at all costs. But the great thing about active travel, I think, is we're not saying to people, don't engage with society, stay at home or whatever. We're saying that actually for a lot of the, and this comes into land use planning as well, a lot of the stuff that you might do, you know, go to the pub, go for dinner, see your friends, go to work, etc., take kids to school, could be done in a smaller radius and could be done via sustainable transport if we start to build the space for it.
And I think one of the problems is with our focus over the last couple of decades on, or few decades, I should say, on road building, we've kind of done that at the expense of other modes of transport and kind of leaving road transport as the only option for people. So bus services have been cut and then there's been very few cycle lanes. And so there aren't that many options for people other than to drive. And so the roads are kind of filling up because actually in terms of length of road, there haven't been a huge sort of length of new road in the last decade or so, but there's been a huge growth of traffic, something like 28 billion miles between 2009 and 2019. And what shocked me was that apparently government's expecting a further increase of up to 51% in road traffic by 2050. If you set that against our net zero goals, which is to cut road traffic by a quarter by 2030, so that's what sort of getting on for 7 years away, those two numbers are obviously in direct opposition, but there's still a huge problem of what they call predict and provide. It's that this assumption that road traffic's always going to grow, and so you always keep growing the road network and improving it, and a lot of the work that we do around roads just increasing the speed at which traffic can move through it. So it's just sort of smoothing corners, increasing width and stuff. But yeah, the kind of the way that we're going is just the way that we've always gone, I guess. And it's just, it's leading entirely in the wrong direction.
Well, yeah, I think there's a level of inevitability about it. You know, I was listening to a Commons debate at 9 o'clock last night because, well, that's what I do. And there was talking about low traffic neighbourhoods. And one of the examples up in the Northwest, you know, they were talking about the air pollution they get from the big roads that they have there. You know, there's that corridor where all the motorways converge. And they were sort of saying, well, we get a lot of air pollution from that. And the logic was, you know, with the main roads around there, is that if you block any of the roads off, the traffic has to go somewhere. And that kind of infers that traffic behaves more like water, where, you know, it has to go somewhere, whereas the evidence seems to show that traffic is more like a gas and it can actually evaporate when you give it less space. So there's all this inevitability that I find, especially around low traffic neighborhoods, where you cannot do anything to impede the flow of motor traffic. And that's just quite fatalistic, because all the kind of local transport plans, you know, I was in the West Midlands, talks about a near 30% reduction in car mileage. So we can't just go with that, you know, that typical predict and provide the law talks about. You know, I think we've got to move it on, and actually some of our engineers are talking about sort of decide and provide and being in charge of our own destiny. So yeah, there's a lot of fatalism about this kind of thing, where cars are going to be around and therefore we have to not do anything to impede them, because that might cause congestion or pollution from people waiting around. But, you know, it's going to be that stat that we referred to, you know, 51% increase in traffic potentially by 2050. That's the government's own predictions. You know, where's it all going to go?
Yeah, it's interesting what's happening in Coventry. I kind of quite like seeing these bike lanes popping up in your area. But it seems like stuff's happening there. And we've only been there, what, less than a year?
Yeah, well, no, less than a year. Yeah, the council's been doing the lion's share of the delivery, so I wouldn't want to take credit for that. But definitely feel like there's a sense of purpose and the politicians, you know, are really supportive. And I think one of the main things is that, you know, the politicians aren't just getting shouted about like they did with, you know, oh, my bins haven't been emptied or whatever it is. People are going, well, actually now I can cycle to school with my kids, so, you know, thank you. And it really makes a real impact on me. And I, you know, I sense that the politicians are sort of, you know, getting a lot from that, and, you know, starting to see the quick benefits of people and the amount of people engaging with the infrastructure as they're building. So they're like, you know, great, let's go and do some more.
And there is some funding for active travel. I mean, you've got a bunch of it, haven't you?
Well, yeah, there's loads of it. The thing to differentiate with the kind of upcoming budget is, well, we've had funding as a nation and we've had funding as a region in the West Midlands. We've had more funding as a nation than we've ever had. And we've had more funding in the West Midlands than we've ever had for active travel. So, you know, if you've got ambition and you've got, you know, the will to do this, you're largely been rewarded by the government. I think the concern is with the budget, we're getting to the point where we need a multi-year settlement to really do this properly. So often we only get budgets for active travel year on year. You have to bid for it. And you can then only put people on like fixed term contracts for less than 12 months. So you're not getting the kind of skills growth, job growth, continuity, network planning that you need. You're waiting year on year to see what you can do. So a multi-year settlement is going to be really, really important. And, you know, it's what they do for like other stuff like roads and rail. You know, they have long-term funding streams or longer-term funding streams at least. And these three-year settlements could be really transformational. So we, you know, we definitely need them and we need that longevity.
How does that work, Adam? So I don't, with, but I mean, this isn't technically a budget, is it?
Well, it's an autumn statement, so they can, you know, I guess do, yeah, they can announce stuff, they can cut stuff, they can change the budgets. What they might do, just say is, you know, they might say, well, inflation's at 10 or 11%, we're not going to increase our levels of spending with inflation. So that might mean, you know, well, all projects are ongoing now might have to be shorter or find money from somewhere else. And that would be a challenge in itself.
Yeah. So, but if you were to get out of this a three-year settlement from central government, that takes you into the first year of a new, potentially a new government, doesn't it, post the general election? So it's kind of like built-in instability, isn't it, in terms of... So presumably, if there were to be a change of government completely, if the Labour Party were to come in, which is, according to the polls, quite likely at the moment, they might... I have no idea what their active travel policy might look like, but they might come in and say, we'll increase it, or even we'll cut it. And then are they bound by any three-year commitment?
I mean, yeah, there's always a way to get out, but if someone gives you a longer-term commitment, in general, all that means you can budget, you have the security to do that. So, you know, you don't often see people pull from there. But yeah, I guess the thing that people, it's more, you know, the fact that people, well, some people complain about this, we've done actually quite well out of this, but it's the sort of beauty parade that you have to do with competitive bidding. So, you know, you might, if you want to access this fund, you have to put a presentation, and often it's, you know, 20 or 30,000 words, and you just sort of get a yes or a no at the end of it. So as I say, I think we've done quite well out of it, but the long-term security and stability that comes from having a dedicated longer-term budget is, you know, can't be underestimated. It's really, really important. 3 years sounds like a long way off, but it will come up quick, I'm sure. You know, I think the bit where we're at now is that most of the political parties, mainstream political parties, really understand that active travel is a thing, and, you know, they're not dubious about it. So I think regardless of what happens in politics, you know, active travel is being taken seriously. And, you know, that's...
Shouldn't underestimate that, actually.
Yeah, like when we started the podcast here, it was sort of, we now had a dedicated active travel fund, you know, back in 2020, not that long ago. And now it definitely feels...
And now it feels part of the landscape.
Yeah, that long-term stability can be super important, not just for the West Midlands, but I think local authorities across the country would all pretty much say the same things. And one of the ways to get that, I think, is to really get across the return on investment. So going back to, you know, saying for the Transport Secretary, I'd be saying for, you know, for every £1 invested in cycle lanes, you know, return on average between £5 and £6, and, you know, in those wider economic and health benefits, etc. And that's even in a system that is sort of, you know, rigged against sustainable transport. You know, we still place a huge value in these calculations on car drivers and their time, and, you know, people in cars have a higher value than people on public transport, for example, and productivity, which is sort of a bit odd. But we have a very, very high return on investment, and we can do this very, very quickly. So I think that's what we should be focusing on rather than seeing it as a luxury.
Mm. Yeah, that the whole thing about kind of valuing car drivers' time so highly, part of that is because of, I guess, their sort of contributing car tax at the moment, vehicle excise duty, and with electric cars coming in, that's going to be less of a, because it make a huge kind of hole in the government's revenue, isn't it? And there was talk maybe, I think the government was talking about putting vehicle excise duty onto electric cars to try and plug the gap. But so I wonder if that's going to change as fossil fuel cars, petrol and diesel cars are kind of phased out and electric cars come in. But who knows? The kind of economic value thing's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it is so high and it's still undervalued. But Susjoen's estimated it was something like 36 billion in sort of economic benefits in 2021.
To active travel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and walking,
yeah.
Which, you know, is substantial. There was a work 5 years ago as well in the Bicycle Association showing that the British cycling industry was worth more than the British steel industry, which was sort of surprising.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I wrote a book about football last year and I calculated that Manchester City or Manchester United, I can't remember, had signed a left back who was worth more than the British steel industry. Literally. So the British steel industry is pretty small beer. But nonetheless, I think it's a substantial amount. Yeah. 36 billion? It's either tenuous or absolutely accurate.
Well, yeah, you know, I wasn't, yeah, I was just sounded good. But, well, they're not here to give us a methodology, but I would say, well, someone told me that the Susjoen's data also included people buying shoes if they're walking, which feels a little bit tenuous.
They do wear out, though. The more you walk, the faster they go. And if you're talking about thousands of miles of walking network.
But it's not quite like bike sales, though. It's not as clear-cut as that.
Yeah, these things are always kind of arbitrary, I guess, aren't they? So, yeah, if you kind of extrapolate them.
I think we've got to talk about efficiency as well, because no one is having the conversation we mentioned earlier, which is, you know, car traffic could increase by as much as 51%.
I know, that's astonishing.
Where's it going to go? It's definitely, you know, no one knows. And I think that's untenable for a lot of local politicians who are very concerned about, you know, the popular vote. And yes, on a micro level of thinking to the next election, it might be about the traffic management that's going on outside their roads and in their cities and towns and villages. But really, on a long term, no one's going to tolerate this level of traffic increase that's been unchecked, because, you know, people won't even be able to get out of their front drive or out of their road.
And it's all wear and tear on the roads because they're a bit heavier. I was speaking to some people who live in, they were in Amsterdam and they're now in Arnhem, and they were saying, you know, they've moved out of Amsterdam to the countryside, and they were used to sort of having to walk in Amsterdam 2 or 3, maybe 4 blocks to get their car and to park it. And that was just totally normal for them. And they're laughing because they've moved to this village where everyone's quite sort of, well, it's a town, where everyone's quite sort of parochial about their car park spot, apparently. They left their car in someone else's unofficial spot. But I thought it was quite funny that even there they had that problem. But it's just a very different kind of landscape, isn't it, that we have. We just kind of expect to be able to, you know, wherever we live, to be able to like put our car outside our house, and just having that kind of distance, I think, is also a cost that you factor in when you're deciding whether you decide to take the bike.
Yeah,
outside,
I mean,
your
it's
house
only really when people are financially disincentivized to make the right decision that they do, and we haven't really incentivized the right options for people. And you know, electric cars are fairly cheap to run, and, you know, I've got a very small access to a very small Renault Zoe, but it's effectively still, you know, it's a car, and the back seats are effectively a sofa on wheels, and the average car occupancy is 1.2 people. So in terms of road space efficiency, it's not helpful. So we need to do talk about efficiency and incentivizing that efficiency. And if we somehow build policy that incentivizes using electric cars for short journeys because it's cheap, well, that's just going to be a problem just from a physics and spatial point of view.
How much is a bag tax? 5p? Plastic bags, enormously. It's quite amazing.
Well, if you had to pay £1 to unlock your car like you do with a scooter, I think people might rethink how they... how often they use it for short journeys. Ned, when you're thinking about explaining the benefits, you know, of active traveller, I know that you've mentioned before that your partner works in the NHS. You talk about health benefits and all of those things, but it strikes me that in the active travel lobby hasn't really had much of a conversation about the economic benefits of active travel. So I just wondered, is it something you've ever considered when you're kind of explaining the benefits of, you know, oh, would it benefit my high street? This stuff sounds like really obvious to me as a policy nerd, but I don't know if normal people ever really think like that.
I'm here to represent the normal person. No, massively. I mean, it's one of them. Although there's one thing that strikes me, that bikes aren't free. You know, they're not free. They're not free to buy, and they're not actually free to maintain. There is a certain cost attached, but it is tiny compared to everything else. But there is some sort of like myth out there that somehow that once you've got a bike, that's it. It's kind of free for the rest of you. That's not. You know, bits of bikes are quite expensive. Tires are £40 a pop, aren't they? Sort of, you know, and they're getting more expensive as everything is. Yes, and I do. I was going to ask about the kind of. Well, I was going to turn it. I had a question for you, but they're not unrelated. We are now, I think, heading into a. Well, the experts predict quite prolonged, possibly the longest ever recession on record in this country, and the last quarter returned a shrinking GDP, didn't it? So it looks like it started. Clearly, we don't want to get onto austerity. We kind of did that in an earlier podcast too deeply, but clearly people's disposable income is getting really squeezed or eliminated, eradicated now. And one of the most obvious and compelling answers, and it's very much the case in London, isn't it? That, and I've just done it because I've just had a COVID booster, so I'm not feeling great. So I didn't cycle up to this the six miles up to this podcast meeting. I actually jumped on a train for most of it and then got a hire bike from there. But I resented swiping my contactless card, partly because no one uses Oyster cards anymore, do they? Everyone just uses their contactless bank card mostly. And it doesn't display the price. So it's always quite funny when you tell people what you've just spent in a week if people are going in and out of town, you know, and often those costs are hidden. And when you extrapolate it over a month, that's the biggest single gain, isn't it, in terms of the cost of living if you live in a city.
Yeah, and I think it's going to affect different people in different ways. So I think we talked about this on a previous podcast, but, you know, it not only just affects the decision between heating and eating, but also for people that, you know, are in work and maybe consider themselves as comfortable in most circumstances, they'll be looking at how much a train journey costs them, or, you know, it costs me £100 or £150 a week to fill my car up and I don't really use it that much. And it's going to affect different people in different ways. And I think we can say for sure it's going to have an effect on everybody. And this recession is slightly, you know, I've got a C in GCSE maths, so I'm definitely not an economic expert. But from what I've been hearing about and listening to people analysing this recession is going to be quite, you know, it's quite different because there's a lot of people in work. There's jobs for people, but, you know, for a lot of people, they're looking at their discretionary spend. And if you're spending quite a significant amount of money on your transport and there was there's a free or very low cost option available to you, I think we're going to see a lot more people, shifting.
I think so. And I think it's generational as well, because, you know, the cost of living crisis falls differently on different parts of society. But one of the demographics that are hit the hardest is the younger people who are just entering the workforce and aren't in a position to get big pay rises regularly and are, you know, really scrabbling around with rents that are going up. So I think it'll be possibly an unfortunate set of circumstances will result in a bit of behavioural change in that regard that might well be there to stay, because these things are habit forming. And, you know, I live in Zone 2 in London, just on the fringe of Zone 2, and I think of it as a bottle of wine. Ride in, do it, go to a meeting, ride out, literally that's a bottle of wine I've just saved there. So I tend to pick up I'll pick up a bottle of wine when I get home.
Spending
in my local shop.
Well, yeah, and there's actual real data that shows that people who walk and cycle generally visit the high street
almost frequently. Twice as much as people. I think, pedestrians spend the most, or visit the most. Yeah, then drivers the least, or half as much as pedestrians. Visiting shops half as much as pedestrians. But yeah, I think it's interesting because there was a story in The Guardian from Australia about a load of businesses that were opposing new cycle lanes that had been installed in like Melbourne and Sydney. But I think a lot of the time, although cycle lanes are good for local high streets, as we well know, there's plenty of research around the world on that. But a lot of businesses don't seem to know that. And I think there's a kind of education piece for local businesses and local employers to kind of understand what the benefits are and how people get to where they are and what people like to do when they're there and what kind of draws people into a space. And it's not
a busy thoroughfare full of traffic. It was in debate last night, you know, I was listening and they were saying, oh, well, you know, this is how people get their trade through here. And I was thinking, that's really sort of old fashioned, isn't it? So I used to work in a bike shop growing up, and we were like at crossroads and traffic lights and been there for decades and it's on a crossroads. And we made a whole big deal about this passing trade, but actually, you know, we didn't think about, has this bike shop got good cycle parking, or what happens if there are more cycle trips and or cycle infrastructure in town, and how would that affect
the business? Well, yes, cycling, but even getting away from bicycles, as you say, pedestrians, they're the big thing, and they're going to go much more frequently and much more readily, much more happily to an environment that isn't stinking and noisy. Do you remember the conversations we were having during the height of sort of COVID, when I kind of hit upon this thought, or felt this thought that over and above the messaging coming from central government about social distancing, I thought that the corporations, and specifically supermarkets, were actually doing the heavy lifting. Yeah. They were telling us what to do and how to behave in a way that central government couldn't even begin to be spread that message as powerfully as Sainsbury's and Tesco's and the rest of them, because they were our everyday experience. So even on, you know, I live near a classic London village, but my local little parade of shops, is they call it a village, don't they? It's actually got a lot of traffic coming through it, but it's either Tesco's or Sainsbury's Express opening up for the first time, you know. And those big chains are kind of represented everywhere, where you've got these actually small independent community shops around them. They're typical little high street that you want to see rejuvenated, you know. That's absolutely classic, you know. That's what you want to see grow. But, and I wonder whether the big corporations, they're not daft. They know. They will have looked at this evidence. You know, they don't open a Tesco's Express or a Sainsbury's Express just simply on a whim, do they? They know, good, this will work, even though there's no parking anywhere near, you know. So they could be a driver for spreading that kind of message around the shops on which they rely as well, because, you know, they need a dry cleaners and a barbers and a pizzeria, you know. And I wonder how significant their wealth of accrued kind of expertise in terms of understanding the economics of the high street might be.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember this makes me think of when the big bike lanes were being built by Boris when he was London mayor. There was that big campaign around lots of massive businesses in London supporting the East West Cycle Superhighway, because there were some voices against. Yeah, it was amazing, actually. They had some massive kind of, I don't know, massive organisations, corporations backing this.
Yeah, well, I think Orange backed it, didn't they? The telecoms company, and it was all because of the chair of the Canary Wharf Group. Basically, he hired PR and lobbying firms to go up against the cycle lane because, well, when we looked at it, it's exactly the route that he used to get driven to work in. Allegedly.
That's right. Yeah. And because these companies, and it's not just about their customers, it's also about kind of attracting staff. So if a business can locate itself in a nice pedestrianized area, there's nice cafes, it's like, you know, attracting a workforce, especially today when we're short of kind of workers. You know, if you want to be competitive and get the right staff, then you need to be based somewhere that's really prioritizing the pedestrian realm. And younger people increasingly don't want to be surrounded by traffic. They don't want to drive. They don't want to be surrounded by it.
I heard a really interesting... Sorry, this is quite a rambling discussion, isn't it? But I think it's quite interesting. I heard a really interesting discussion on the radio the other day about... I think it was on Radio 4 about, has the footfall come back to our town centres? Mm. You know, post-working from home and now blended work, hybrid working, whatever it's called. And, you know, there's evidence that it is returning to something like... But it's expressing itself potentially differently. And there seems to be a kind of growing sense of body of evidence that actually footfall in shops in town centres is still markedly down on pre-pandemic levels. Bars and restaurants, despite the credit, you know, the cost of living crisis, are actually returning to something. You know, they're more popular than the shops. And what's being noticed now is that at the weekends, and I really noticed this touring the country on my theatre tour for 5 weeks, at the weekends, city centres and town centres are bustling. And perhaps even more so than before, because a lot of people are doing sort of hybrid working and working from home still, maybe 2-3 days a week, or even 5 days a week from home. And actually, a nice town centre is a nice thing to go and do with the family at the weekend to get you away from your house that you've been essentially locked in for five days a week. I think that's quite an interesting phenomenon as well.
Well, if you think about it as well, if you think about close your eyes and what does that town centre look like, it's definitely, you know, probably pedestrianised. It's probably a place where you can sit outside and have a coffee. There might be some ambience of people talking or music in the background or whatever. It's definitely not, as some people might suggest, like a massive car park. Like, no one wants to go to the city centre just to park their car and then, well, dodge other people's cars next to them. But you listen to some of the discussions I've been having, you think that that's what people would want. And it's just not what... It's very clear that's not, when you close your eyes, what people expect when they, you know, city centres have to thrive, they have to be interesting, and they have to have places to dwell as well as just visit. from an economic standpoint, I think the thing that really gives me hope and reassures me is looking at the City of London. You know, they would say the world's, you know, financial centre. Well, one of the world's financial centres, or I thought we were world beating, but no, they would say that they've, you know, they've done lots of really, really interesting things. You know, they haven't even got 20 zones. They've actually got 15 mile an hour zones. They've built parklets. They've closed roads. They've had junctions remodeled. You know, effectively, the City of London Corporation, it's not a council. And, you know, if the smartest and most financially savvy people in the world and the country, at least, are reshaping their streets to make it more economically viable and more attractive, then I think that's a good thing, and it's good to know that others will probably learn from it and take notes about what they're doing.
Yeah, and they have colossal numbers of pedestrians every day coming in. I mean, I guess presumably it's less since the pandemic, but absolutely enormous numbers of people coming in that every day on foot.
And that's really interesting, because I think you're absolutely right. I've kind of noticed that as well. It's and over the last 10, 15 years, it's changed dramatically, because on Saturdays and Sundays, the city used to be an absolute wasteland, didn't it? Yeah. Quite charming in a way. You wander around, but there's no one there. And now they seem to be there's quite a lot of life at the weekends in those places as well.
Ned, obviously you went up and down the country on your tour. Really interested to hear which was your favourite bit for active travel, urbanism, and which was the most hostile, I guess.
Maybe I can answer that. Both those questions by saying one word: Worcester. Ooh. Now, I think, because I was talking to Laura about this, we maligned Worcester a long time ago. Worcestershire, we maligned. And I can't quite remember why. Can you remember why we maligned them?
Well, so this is quite interesting. They had a cabinet that was, you know, still conservative, held there, but they had a particular kind of set of individuals who, let's say, would not basically give an inch on cycling and on anything. And they had these public space protection orders which ban cycling in the city centre. They've also more recently not getting much money from the Active Travel Fund. So I don't expect you to have read, possibly, Ned, a Conservative Home, but Conservative Home has an article from Mike Rouse, who's the new cabinet member at the council for transport, and he, you know, he's saying all the right things and talking about their ambition and wanting to do the right thing. So I don't know. I think they could be a dark horse of the active travel future.
Well, here's what happened to me. So my wonderful tour manager, Reese, who I travelled around with, in a van basically for 5 weeks, we were crisscrossing the country and up and down the M5 again. And I didn't actually do a show in Worcester, but we kept passing it. And Reese lives in Worcester. He's moved there. He's got a young family. And as we drove past Worcester for the first time, I went, "Wow, see Reese." I went, "See." Worcester's very much frowned upon in the active travel community. So you've got a black mark here for, you know. And Reese is the most understated, gently intelligent person I've ever met, right? And he just let me sort of say my piece, and then he was quiet for 30 seconds. And then he went, "It's funny you say that, because I around where I live and just outside the city centre, quite a lot of lovely bike lanes." And I went, "Well, ever." And then as we drove past Worcester, we drove underneath a brand new looking bridge that he just pointed at. He said, "That's just for cycle. That's just for bikes." And I went, "Really?" And it looked amazing. And then we drove on a little bit further, and then he just showed me this enormous new cycle lane that was like. And he goes, "I go out with the kid all the time. We just we can go for miles on cycle lanes like that, and they go right past my house, and I get everywhere." And I went, "Okay, so maybe
maybe we should go back and set the record straight."
Absolutely, that's a good idea. We should do that. We should do that. Invite ourselves around to Reese's house. Is that it? Are we done? All right, you've been listening to Streets Ahead. As ever, our editor has been Claire Mansell. Please let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate us and review us and share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it from Worcester. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.